This act also makes it mandatory for the authorized person to report any occurrence of any accident at institution or the facility where the waste is handled or any other site where biomedical waste is handled or during transportation of such waste to the prescribed authority immediately. Now, how do you treat, dispose and the transportation of biomedical waste happens? The rule provides that biomedical waste shall not be mixed with other waste, and at the point of generation should be segregated into labeled containers, as I said previously, bags prior to storage, transportation, treatment and disposal. So generally, you know, you have different colored bags which helps us use to segregate the waste. So for clinics, you have typical colored bags. For hospitals, where you know you are just collecting waste, if needles are there, then they're separate bags. So that's how you segregate the waste. The biomedical waste shall be transported in vehicle authorized by the competent authority. So the vehicles are given, and in that only it is to be transported. It is categorically mentioned that no untreated biomedical waste shall be kept stored for a period beyond 48 hours. This is very important. You know, you just cannot keep the waste lying idle. Ideally nothing beyond 48 hours. And registration and renewal procedure: every occupier of an institution generating, collecting, receiving, storage, transporting, treating, disposing and or handling biomedical waste in any other manner except such occupier of clinics, dispensaries, pathological laboratories, blood banks, providing treatment service to less than 1000 patients per month, operator of a biomedical waste facility, shall make an application form to the prescribed authorities for grant of authorization along with the prescribed fees. So every, they have an annual fees which have to be paid, and registration is to be taken with such authorities so that you know the waste is given to them and finally disposed of in a proper way. The prescribed authority shall, on receipt of application and inquiry thereof regarding the capacity to handle the biomedical waste in accordance with these rules, grant or renew an authorization as the case may be. An authorization shall be granted for a period of 3 years, including an initial trial period of for 1 year from the date of issue. Thereafter, an application shall be made by the occupier for renewal. So it is generally every 3 years, and there is a trial period of 1 year from the date of issue, post which there is a renewal which has to be done by the occupier. Now, Biomedical Waste Amendment Rules 2003, Ministry of Environment and Forest Notification, New Delhi, 17 September 2003. These rules may be called as the Biomedical Waste Rules 2003. They shall come into force on the date of the publication in the Official Gazette. In Rule 7 of the Biomedical Waste Rules 1998, in Subrule 1, the prescribed authority for enforcement, the words "save as otherwise provide the prescribed authority for enforcement" shall be substituted, and after subrule 2, the following subrule shall be inserted, which is 1A, the prescribed authority for enforcement of four provisions of these rules in respect of health, all healthcare establishments, which are the hospitals, the nursing homes, the clinics, dispensaries, veterinary institutions, animal houses, pathological laboratories and blood banks of the armed forces under the Ministry of Defence, shall be the Director General, Armed Forces Medical Services. Now let's discuss the Trust Act. Registrations are done either under the Societies Registration Act or the Bombay Public Trust Act. The Societies Registration Act is a central state and is applicable nationwide. The Bombay Public Trust Act was passed in 1950 by the erstwhile state of Bombay, including the present Maharashtra and Gujarat states, to tackle the issues of misadministration and mismanagement of religious and charitable trust. So we've seen a lot of trusts, you know, which are not handled in a proper way, where they are supposed to offer treatments at a subsidized rates to the people, but that is not happening, or where the accounts are not in a proper way. So to tackle all these issues, this act was there. However, any registration done under the Societies Registration Act also automatically gets converted into the registration under the Bombay Public Trust. Now, what is the meaning of the word trust? The Indian Trust Act, which gives elaborate principles about the concept of trust, defines trust as an obligation annexed to the ownership of property and arising out of the confidence reposed in and accepted by the owner, or declared and accepted by him for the benefit of another, or another and the owner. So it is basically an obligation which an owner of a property has to give, and which he accepts that he will give for the benefit of the other. Thus, in simple words, it means that trust is a transfer of property by the owner to another for the benefit of the third person, along with or without himself. This is very important, you know. He might or might not be benefited, but the other person has to be benefited. The purpose of the trust must be lawful. That is, it should be forbidden, should not be forbidden by law. Number one, should not be of such nature that if permitted, it would defeat the provisions of any law. Should not be fraudulent. Should not involve injury to the property or person of another. Should not be of such nature as would be regarded as immoral. A person competent to contract can create a trust, that is a major person of sound mind and not disqualified by any other law. So any person who is of sound mind and not disqualified by any other law can form, can create a trust. The information required for registration is to be for a trust is, first, what is the name of the trust, the name and address of all the trustees, the mode of succession to the office of the trustees, that is, will the trustees be nominated and elected, and if elected, for what duration would they hold the post, the appropriate value of the movable and the immovable property, and the address of the trust. What is the gross annual average income of the trust property based on the average of the preceding 3 years, approximate average annual expenditure, and what is the main objective of the trust. So all these details have to be given in. After the above, relevant documents with an application for registration are submitted. The Deputy Assistant Charity Commissioner will scan and check the documents to ascertain whether really a trust exists, most important point. Whether a trust, does such a trust really exist, what are the objectives of the trust and whether are they charitable or not, who are the trustees, what is the source of income for trust. After the deputy or the assistant charity commissioner is satisfied about these queries, he passes the order for registering the society trust and the registration certificate is issued. So once the charity commissioner is satisfied about all the answers to all the above questions, he passes the order for registering the society or the trust and the certificate is given. In the case of a society, the certificate of registration of the society is issued first and the certificate of registration of the trust is issued later. So in case if it's a society, then first it has to be registered as a society and then as a trust. Thus a body originally registered as a society gets two registration certificates and two numbers, that is for a society and as a trust. The registrar is known as the Schedule one registered. Change report. The trustees are under obligation to report to the charity commissioner regarding any changes that take place in the entries recorded in the schedule. Thus, if there is any change in the trustees or the trust properties, the office of the trust, the object, the rules, regulation, all these things have to be reported to the charity commissioner. The trustees must report these changes in 90 days to the assistant charity commissioner. So within 3 months, it has to be reported. Change in trustees. If any of the trustees if they die or they resign, disclaim or leave the country or permanently settle abroad, then the composition of the trustee board may change due to periodical elections as per the rules and regulations. So these things have to be informed to the charity commissioner. The trust property may acquire a new property or may dispose or alienate the trust property. If this is to be informed, the trust may change its objects by either adding or deleting any of its objects. There may be change in the rules and regulation depending on the new committee which is elected. So all these things have to be informed to the charity commissioner. In the eventuality of any of the above changes, the trustees are legally bound to report to the changes to the charity commissioner. Such change reports to the changes to the charity commissioner, and such change report should specify first what is the nature of the change, what is the reason for the change, and if there are any other remarks. It is also necessary for the trustees to submit necessary and relevant documents in support of the reported changes. So it is the duty of the trustees to submit the detailed report of all these changes to the charity commissioner. If the new trustees are to taken over from the old trustees, then consent letters of both incoming and the outgoing trustees is very, very important. If the deletion of trustees is due to the death of the trustee, then the death certificate should accompany the change report. Now comes a very important part, that is the budget, account, the audit. Budget. The trustees of the public trust which has an annual income exceeding rupees 5,000 in case of a trust for public religious purpose and rupees 10,000 in other cases has to submit at least 1 month before the commencement of the accounting year a budget showing probable receipt and expenses during the year. So in case if the trust is has an annual income which exceeds 5,000 and is for a public religious purpose and rupees 10,000 in any other case, they have to submit this report at least 1 month prior to the commencement of the accounting year. This budget must have provisions for carrying out the objects of the trust and the maintenance of the trust property. It is also necessary to send a copy of this resolution passed by the Board of Trustees sanctioning the budget. So the budget must have the provisions for carrying out the objects. So the objects are duly laid down. Provisions have to be made for carrying out these objects. And a resolution copy is to be sent by the Board of Trustees sanctioning this budget. Now, maintenance of accounts. It is compulsory for all the trusts to keep regular and proper accounts. This is one of the most important points because it is generally in the case of accounts that the scanning happens. And so just to see that there is no misuse of funds or misappropriation of funds, proper accounts has to be maintained. The accounts have to be balanced on the 31st March and to be audited by a chartered accountant. After the auditor has certified the accounts, they have to be submitted to the charity commissioner in the prescribed manner from the 6 months of the closing of the financial years. So within 6 months of the closing of the financial years, these have to be submitted. The statements of accounts are then scrutinized at the charity commissioner's office to check whether the expenditures are incurred properly on the objects of the trust. So though they are certified by a CA, they would be rechecked at the charity commissioner's office. Now, investment of public trust money. When the trust property consists of money and cannot be applied immediately or at an early date to the purpose of the trust, the trustees are bound to deposit the money in the specified securities and bonds in any specified institution. The money can be invested best in nationalized banks, cooperative banks, or a specified foreign banks, or in some institution industries. This generally happens, you know, when the trustees would not immediately apply the money at an early date for the purposes of the trust. So money should not lie idle hands. They should be invested in these institutions. Investment in the purchase of immovable property. Trustees have to seek the charity commissioner's consent while making investment in the purchase of immovable property. The following particulars must be submitted along with the application seeking consent. A true copy of the resolution of the trustees, very important. If the property is to be constructed, then the estimated cost along with the estimate and the plans. If already built up property is there and it is to be purchased, then the valuation report by a valuator, ideally, that is by an expert. Complete details regarding the location of the property, such as the survey number, the HISA number, the road, taluka, etc., everything. Copy of documents regarding proposed transaction, that is the agreement of sale or sale deed, and the value of financial consideration of the property, the details as to from which source the consideration will be supplied. So all these details have to be submitted to the charity commissioner in case the trust is planning to buy an immovable property. The present status of the money source, so whatever the current state of accounts is there, net annual return of the proposed investment, so a project report where you know what is the annual returns once they are going to invest this funds. The present investment pattern of the trust, is it in compliance with the objects of the trust, particulars of the trust, income and money spent on the objects of the trust for the last 3 years, and whether the person for whom the property sought to be purchased is related to any of the trustees or is anyways concerned with the trust. So this is again very important. The person from whom the property is sought to be purchased, whether does he is he a family member of any of the trustees or is anyway concerned with the trust, that is also very important. If the trust intends to make additional construction for its object, it is not necessary to take permission. However, if the said construction is to earn more income, then it is necessary to obtain prior consent. So any additional construction is, if it is required, if it is for, if it falls within the normal routine construction activities, then it's fine. However, if the construction is basically done, you know, to earn more income, and then it is very necessary to obtain prior consent from the charity commissioner. The charity commissioner has to assess any such application with a view to ascertain whether such construction will be beneficial to the trust or no. The permission is granted only after the charity commissioner is satisfied. Let us now discuss the power and duties of trustees. So every trustee is supposed to administer the affairs of the trust and utilize funds and the properties of the trust as per the terms of the trust and directions of the charity commissioner. So it is very important that the trustees follow what they are supposed to do. They have to manage the affairs of the trust in the prescribed manner what has been laid down before the charity commissioner. There are certain restrictions on trustees. The trustees cannot borrow money on behalf of the trust except with the previous consent of the charity commissioner, and trustees cannot borrow money for their own use from any of property of the public trust. So they cannot borrow money only for their own use, and if at all they are borrowing money, also it has to be done with the consent of the charity commissioner. Control of the charity commissioner. The charity commissioner, the deputy assistant charity commissioners have the power to enter and inspect any property of a public trust and also to call for any books of accounts or documents in possession of the trustees and to get an explanation from the trustees. They are also entitled to issue directions to the trustees or persons concerned to the trust for proper administration of the trust property and income. So, charity commissioner's office has the full powers, rights. They can enter the offices, they can check the books of accounts and whatever documents that they intend to, and they can also issue directions to the trustees connected with the trust for proper administration in case they are receiving or if they have any information regarding misuse of the funds. The charity commissioner can also issue directions to ensure that the incomes of the trust is properly appropriated towards the object of the trust and that the property of trust is not wasted or damaged. So it is the duty actually of the charity commissioner to see that whatever the objectives of the trust that have been laid down before him, those are getting fulfilled and the property is not wasted or damaged. The charity commissioner has the power to suspend, remove or dismiss any trustee, if the trustee makes persistent defaults in submission of the accounts or willfully disobeys any orders issued by the charity commissioners, continuously neglects his duty or commits any breach of trust, misappropriates any trust property, or is convicted for any of offense involving moral turpitude. So in these cases, the charity commissioners have the power to remove the people who are defaulting, the trustees who are defaulting continuously in the submission of accounts, or if they are receiving any complaints on for them. Contribution by public trust to the public trust administration fund. All public trusts have to pay annually a contribution to the public trust administration fund. This contribution is at a rate not exceeding 5% of the gross annual income or receipts of the trust. So 5% of their annual gross income is to be contributed to the public trust administration fund. Some deductions are allowed while computing the income or receipts. Now, what are the powers of charity commissioners to issue directions to hospital trust? Powers of charity commissioners to issue directions to hospital trust. Several hospitals are started and run by charitable trust registered under the Bombay Public Trust Act. So, if you see a lot of medical centers, diagnostic centers, hospitals are running under the Trust Act. These trusts avail of facilities and assistance to some conditions on such big trust hospitals to provide medical services to poor or not so well off persons. So the whole agenda or the whole aim of these trusts is to provide hospital facilities and services to the poor people, to the poor sections of the society. The Bombay Public Trust Act was therefore suitably amended in 1985. And as for the provisions, the charitable hospital and legal provisions, the power of charity commissioner in state government is to issue directions in respect of hospital to earmark certain beds, etc., for poor patients to be treated free of charge or at concessional rates. So, there are many hospitals which have been given favors also, but the only condition in their cases, you have to give certain beds for the poor people or provide certain free of charge treatments, and this has to be followed properly by these hospitals. to reserve and earmark 10% of the total number of operational beds and 10% of the total capacity of the patients treated at such medical centers for medical examination and treatment in each department of the medical patients seeking admission or treatment, who shall be medically examined and treated and admitted as the case may be free of charge. So these hospitals are directed, you know, to keep aside 10% of the hospital beds and of the total capacity of the patients, and to treat patients at a concessional rates to the poorer sections of the society. It shall be the duty of every trustee or person connected with such medical center to comply with the direction issued under subsection 1 and to afford all reasonable facilities and assistance required by the side officer or the charity commissioner or his representative for verification of implementation of such directions under clause A and to comply with the requirements thereunder. So every duty is bound by this, you know, they have to or any person who is connected with such medical center, they have to comply with the norms which are laid down by the charity commissioner and to comply with all the requirements that are there. In case there is any dispute relating to the interpretation or implementation or any matter whatsoever in respect to the direction issued under subsection 1, it shall be referred to the state government through the charity commissioner for appropriate direction. So in case of dispute, it is always referred to the state government for the necessary directions. Now, scheme by the Bombay Honorable Bombay High Court. For charitable hospitals, medical treatment with concessional rate to patients belonging to the weaker sections of the society, scheme approved by the High Court was with effect to 1/9/2006. The scheme for treatment to such patients was for the purposes of Section 41A of the BPT Act 1950, approved by the Divisional Bench of High Court Mumbai, is as follows. The public charitable trust registered under provision of the BPT Act, which are running charitable hospitals, including nursing homes or maternity homes, dispensaries or other centers for medical relief and whose annual expenditure exceeds rupees 5 lakhs, are state-aided public trust with the meaning of clause 4 of section 14A. So whenever the annual expenditure of such centers is exceeds 5 lakhs, they are state-aided public trust. The public charitable trust covered by the aforesaid clause shall be under legal obligation to reserve and earmark 10% of the total number of operational beds to the poor sections of the society and to provide medical treatment to the indigent patients free of cost, and reserve and earmark 10% of the total number of operational beds at concessional rates to the weaker section patients as per the provision of section 41A of the BPT Act 1950. So all such institutes which are covered under this are under obligation to provide 10% of the total number of operational beds for poor patients. In emergency, the charitable hospital must admit the patient immediately and to provide to the patient essential medical facilities for all life-saving emergency treatment and procedure till stabilization. So whenever there is an emergency for such patients, come what may, immediately the patient has to be admitted and all the necessary medical facilities are to be provided. Each public charitable hospital shall create a separate fund which may be called the Indigent Patients Fund for the sake of brevity and shall credit 2% of gross billing of all patients without any deduction. So all such charitable institutes have to create a separate fund for such patients, and 2% of the gross billing of all patients shall be kept aside without any deductions. Donations that may be received by the charitable hospitals from individuals or any other charitable trust or from any other source of providing medical treatment to the indigent and weaker section shall be credited to the IPF account. So the IDF account is the Indigent Patients Funds account. So whatever donations that are received by these charitable centers and hospitals from individuals or maybe from other trusts, they have to provide medical treatment to these people. The charitable hospital shall provide following non-billable services free of cost to the indigent patient as well as weaker section patients, that is the bed, RMO services, the nursing care, food if provided by the hospital, linen, water, electricity and routine diagnostics as required for treatment of general specialties and housekeeping services. Otherwise, if we see normally in a private hospital, you know, all this, the beds are charged, RMO service, everything is chargeable. So In case of charitable hospitals, they have to provide the non-billable services free of cost to these patients. In case of indigent patients, the charitable hospital shall provide medical examination and treatment in each department totally free of cost. The charitable hospital shall not ask for any deposit in case of admission. Again, this is a very good point because a majority of the hospitals today take a deposit amount once the patient is admitted. But when we talk of people who cannot afford, the weaker, the poor section of the society, in their cases, when they are getting admitted to charitable hospitals, there would be no deposits. In case of weaker section patients, the charitable hospital shall provide medical examination and treatment in its search department at concessional rates. The charitable hospital shall physically transfer 2% of the patient billing in each month to its IPF account. The charitable hospital shall furnish information to the office of the charity commissioner regarding the amount collected in the IPF account, the treatment which was provided to these patients and the weaker patients and their profiles prepared by the medical social worker and the amount spent for the respective patient along with the information required to be sent under Rule 25A of the BPT Rules 1951. So all these records have to be maintained and these records have to be sent to the office of the charity commissioner regarding the amount that was collected in the IPF account, what was the treatment provided and the profiles of these patients. The trustees of the charitable hospital shall not provide medical facilities to their relatives, to the employees of the trust and their dependents in category of the indigent and the weaker section patients. So essentially these charitable hospitals are for the poor people and unnecessary usage of these facilities by people who can afford it at private centers should be discouraged. The charitable hospital shall admit indigents or weaker sections patients coming to their hospital from any source or through government hospitals or municipal hospitals, etc. The procedure for admissions of patients shall be provided in the subsequent clauses. Now, in case of notifiable diseases, is any disease that is required by law to be reported to the government authorities. The collection of information allows the authorities to monitor such diseases and provide early warning in case of possible outbreak. So typical whenever it's a disease that's going to spread, you know, so all the possible information has to be collected and early warnings have to be provided in case of possible outbreaks. Chickenpox, cholera, hepatitis A, tuberculosis, anemia, all these are examples. Let's look at the major ones. AIDS, which is caused by a virus called as human immunodeficiency virus. There are about 13 million cases by 1999 worldwide and 6.7 million in South and Southeast Asia. It's scary. It is transmitted from person to person through sexual contact, straining of virus contaminated needles and syringes, and transfusion of infected blood. We just discussed the biomedical waste. And this is a very important point, that how if the biomedical waste is not collected and disposed of separately, what is the kind of infections that can happen, you know. So contaminated needles, syringes, they are all a possible cause of spreading AIDS. So they have to be kept separately, disposed of in a proper way. Transmission and the contact with saliva, tears, all these are also possible causes of AIDS. How do you prevent AIDS? Having sexual intercourse with wife and husband only. So abstain from sexual intercourse with unknown persons, use of condoms during sexual acts, use of sterilized needles, very important, syringes and disposable needles, screening of blood and blood products. So I would not even say sterilized needles or syringes, the best is disposable ones. And now there is a method of disposing also the needles and the syringes, you know, you have to destroy it rather than just keeping it, because you never know, once they are out, some person might reuse it. So the best is to destroy it. Care in handling, using and disposing of blood and blood products, needles and sharp instruments, and a disinfection of equipment contaminated.